Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for the needlework artists. Our artist this week, Misty Purcell, Luminous Fiber Arts. Hi, Misty.
Hi, Gary.
Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Got to meet there at the Nashville Market, so that was fun. Yes. Let's talk about that in a minute, though, because we got to talk about Fire Poppies, who's sponsoring the show. Susan Winter at Fire Poppies. And speaking of the Nashville Market, now they're all set up for automatic delivery of three series for you collectors of series: The Secret Santa by Hands on Design, Christmas Square Dance by Hearts in Hand, and 365 Days of Warm Woolly Welcomes by Amy Brucken. And that starts in June. That one starts in June. So if you are one of those, or if you want to start one of those series, call the shop. Call Fire Poppies, 843-225-7208. And shipping and payment information, that'll get you on the list. Then you don't have to think about it after that. They'll set it off each time that a new one is released for whatever series or multiple series you choose. And then someday in the mail, you get to have some fun. Shows up. Can't beat that. And then also Fire Poppies will be participating in the Brenda Gervais Coming to America series. So you'll want to ask them about that. That looks to be pretty impressive. So both of those. And then, of course, Fire Poppies' full run of needlework, Conic Canvas, Cross Stitch, the whole shooting match. And so especially... now, as we're recording this during the quarantining period, be sure and support them online. We want to support all of our shops with online sales as they close their doors. So make sure you check that out. Misty, let's see. We got Vaughn all excited about the Farm Fresh Eggs thing at the Nashville Market. That was your first one, right?
My first market, yep.
And you just dove in head first.
Yeah, when they said there was an opening, I had a moment of indecision. And I called my friend and she's like, yeah, I can help you. Let's do it. And I said, okay.
Oh, boy. Was that now when you decided to do that, did you already have designs that could be held till Nashville? Or were you scrambling right away to put something together to have something fresh for the show?
No, luckily I already had three designs that I planned out to be releasing in 2020. Uh-huh. And so one of them was already stitched. Another one was designed but hadn't been stitched. And then the other one was, I was still tweaking the design. So then I ended up just trying to come up with, you know, one or two more once I found out that I was in, and then, you know, getting everything stitched and ready.
Yeah. At least you didn't have to scramble. So that's good.
No, yeah. it was not a bad scramble. And I just knew, you know, well, if worse comes to worse and I just have three, then I'll have three, you know, but it was nice that I was able to get another design done, which was the Farm Fresh Eggs, actually.
Oh, it was. That was the last one. Huh? Okay.
Yep.
Yep, I'm sure we'll see a Vanna stitch and finish of that in the next couple of months, without a doubt. Yes, she talked about that many times. So was that then you had to figure out everything right out of the gate? I'm sure you got plenty of help from other designers, but quite a challenge to put a room together and figure out how you're going to display and then figure out how you're going to take orders and process money exchanges and so on and so forth. That must have been quite a checklist.
It was. There is a lot to think about. And, you know, it's just like normally you're releasing designs and doing a lot, but then having all these other kind of new experiences, like you said, like how will I take payment and how can I do that efficiently so people aren't waiting around? And how do I want to have the display in the room? Which was, you know, I really wasn't even deciding that until maybe a couple weeks before the show, because I didn't have quite everything ready to do that. But yeah, there's just like a lot of thought and preparation that goes into it. And I think especially for someone who's doing it the first time,
yeah,
you know, there's just a lot to keep track of.
Right. Oh yeah, I can just all the little things that when you get there become big issues if you forgot them. Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, I felt really good about it. I felt like I was really well prepared, and that, you know, talking to other designers really helped me. And when I went through the show and was done with the show, there were very minor things that I would change for next year. So it made me feel really good that it went so smoothly.
Oh, that's terrific right there. That's a victory.
Yeah, it was a really good show. Just all around, it was a great experience.
Yeah, well, that's great. That's great. No, I was really excited to see so many new designers at the show, first-time people, and just speaks so well for the future of the hobby.
I agree. It's really, it feels like a really exciting time to be a designer or a stitcher, you know, to be involved in stitching. There's just a lot of excitement right now, and a lot of, I feel like there's a lot of innovation in the designs and in the fabrics and the flosses, and it's just, it's really, really awesome.
Yeah, it is. I'm glad to hear you say that, because that's kind of been the way I've felt. Even just the last 2 years, I've really felt like the whole design effort, particularly in cross stitch, has really grown, maybe even mm-hmm. reached a new level, in that people mm-hmm. are doing things that are kind of things that have always been part of cross stitch. I felt even those types of designs have reached a different level, and it's really great, because it shows progress, and it shows that people are really trying to advance the hobby, and it's a real plus, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree.
How do you get started in this needlework thing? Did you learn at an early age?
Yeah, I was probably around 11 or 12, and my mom taught me how to cross stitch. She did a little bit of stitching, and she did a little bit of everything. So I learned a lot of different crafts as a kid, and she got me a dimensions kit. and so, like a lot of people,
everybody with the dimensions kit, yes.
Old school dimensions kit. Yep. Yeah. So I did like one cross stitch project, and then I didn't pick it up again for probably another decade. Then when I was in college, I became interested in cross stitch again.
Hmm. See, that gap, some people stitch through that, but there is that gap, that high school year range
mm-hmm.
where, yeah, there's too many other things to do. Yeah.
Yeah, I was doing other things. I was in 4-H, which was where I did some of the crafting, but I was in band, and I just had a lot of other things going on, writing. I was doing writing. So, but in college, a lot of the crafts were experiencing a resurgence, and I had friends who were picking up knitting, and I had a friend who was bringing quilt books to our room and showing me her quilts. And so I wanted to get back into doing some kind of fiber art, and cross stitch was the thing that I, at the time, you know, remembered how to do.
Right,
so
right.
I tried to pick that back up.
Yeah. That, and it's that story is told time and again, where something you learn that as a child, and it gets mm-hmm. put on a shelf somewhere, and then the right moment comes along, and up it pops again. And especially in college, you know, what a nice mental release from study.
Yeah. Yeah. And I found it to be very meditative. And mm-hmm. I do it, you know, cross stitch for me is just really, really relaxing most of the time, unless I'm, you know, I'm picking something.
Yeah. 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 That. That. Yep. Yeah. That, so then you, when you graduate and go on to what you're a professor at Penn State now and go on to mm-hmm. teach, does that carry with you, or do we have yet another gap?
No, I kept, once I graduated college, I kept up with, needle arts in general. I took up knitting. I learned how to quilt. I kept cross stitching. There were a few years, somewhat recently, where I got really sucked into weaving, and then I didn't really cross stitch for a few years. And then, I started following someone who wove and stitched, and that kind of got me back into following stitchers on Instagram and then finding FlossTube, and then I just kind of fell back in love with cross stitch. And
yeah, that weaving, now that's a different world, isn't it?
Yeah. It is. It's awesome though.
Yeah. You have your own loom, or how'd you go? Yeah.
Yeah. I started with a rigid heddle loom, which is a small, more portable loom. And there were, there's a lot of online classes and resources for weaving on a smaller loom like that. And it's very accessible and more affordable. And it's kind of a good gateway if you're like a knitter or crocheter. It's a good gateway into weaving. And then eventually I got hooked enough that I decided to get a floor loom. And it's really, I really like weaving on the floor loom. I couldn't go back probably to the rigid heddle loom so easily now, because the floor loom is just a lot faster, and you can do a lot more complex things in an easier way.
So you still have it? Still weave?
Huh, I haven't had time to weave since I started designing and dyeing fabric. So it's under a sheet in my craft room, sadly, but maybe I'll get a chance to get back to it. I'm enjoying though, you know, I'm loving the designing and I love the dyeing. So it's a fine trade-off, because I'm happy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting how those things all related, and then one gets set aside because another draws more interest at the time, and you tend to go down a path and there it is sitting over in the corner. And and so, something along the way will trigger it again, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, I get moments where I want to pull it back out. The other problem is now that room where I was weaving has basically turned into my shipping room and my fabric pressing room, and so there's not like quite the room for, there's not enough, as much space to weave as there was.
Yeah.
So it's not like I can easily walk up and just sit down to a project and right. work on it. So I'd have to be very intentional about it. Maybe in the summer, but I'll probably be designing realistically.
Yeah. You've started down that evil path. It's going to be hard to back off now. Yep.
I know. I'm having a lot of fun with it. So it's hard to stop. It's kind of addicting.
Yeah. Yeah. Where does the dyeing come in? Dyeing linen? Because that's usually something that somebody does strictly on its own.
Yeah. I'm not good at doing just one thing.
I got that. I got that. Yeah.
It's kind of a story of my life. I got interested because I couldn't always find the color of linen that I wanted for a project easily. So, you know, there aren't a lot of needlework shops, like brick and mortar shops, near me. And if I had a specific project in mind with a specific color, I might go to, two or three shops and not find the color I wanted in the count that I wanted, which oftentimes was 40 count. And, you know, what I've found in my own personal experience is that there's more range of color in like 32 and 28 because more people stitch on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just thinking like, well, maybe I can dye my own fabric. And so I watched Michelle Rudy's tutorial on how to dye with Rit and did that. And I was just amazed that it turned out so well. So I was like, well, this is kind of fun. And then I just kind of kept doing it. And then my friend Cynthia encouraged me and she's like, you should get some professional textile dyes and, you know, get some linen and actually try dyeing it and selling it in your Etsy shop. At the time I already had an Etsy shop and I was selling my weaving. So I gave it a try and it was a lot harder to work with those dyes, but the results were more consistent and it just took me a while to kind of figure out how to dye fabric to get it to look the way I wanted to. I started with a book on dyeing quilting fabric and then tried to adjust the process to linen. So it took me, I don't know, I mean, I probably spent 2 or 3 months playing around before I dared release any fabric. And I don't know. I think I put like 13 little pieces of fabric in my shop, hoping someone would buy one. And people bought them in a couple hours. They were all gone and I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. Well, that linen is an interesting aspect of needlework because shops have such a time getting it, and mm-hmm. and you get a popular color or somebody does a design on a color, and I know more than once I've heard from shop owners that, boy, if I could just get linen, and then at Nashville, you know, all the linen's gone within the first few hours.
Yes.
And,
yes.
You know, grab it quick. And
right.
And that, you know, that it's an interesting aspect. And so, you know, I think anybody who can dye linen and do it at a high level will have no trouble moving the stuff with, but now, and that was something I was curious about, because you hear about people who, oh, I can dye, and then they'll break out the writ dye. And it always seemed to me like for one-off or personal use, that was probably functional.
But yeah, it's a good way to go if you're just doing it for yourself.
Yeah. But if you're trying to do it at some consistent level, you really need to move to that professional dye level then.
Right. Yeah, I would say it's hard to be consistent with the writ dye. And it's more consistent with the professional textile dyes. And, you know, you still have surprises. I've had times where I did everything I normally did, and sometimes the color turned out different, and I have no idea why. It's still kind of a mystery to me, the process, even though I've been doing it for a while now, and I'm starting to understand it better. But yeah, there's just times where I don't know what happens, but you know, here's a new color for a solo that I stick in the shop, because I don't know if I was distracted or I know I wasn't, but somehow something happened. And
right.
Yeah.
Now when you do that with professional dyes, can you literally write out a recipe, as in 2 tablespoons of this and a cup of this and a cup of this, and that gets me the color?
Well, that's what I do. I don't know what other people do, but yeah, I mean, when I'm testing a fabric, I usually do like a fat quarter size, mm-hmm. just to start testing a color. And then, you know, I write down the recipe for that, and how many teaspoons or, you know, whatever I was using. It's usually teaspoons at that point. And then once I get it right on the fat quarter, and then I test it at the half yard length, and then I test it at the yard length. And I don't dye bigger than a yard right now, because that's just kind of what I can handle.
Yeah.
But you know, then I'm repeat testing it to try to get it consistent. And then I dye also Aida, and I dye Lugana and Linda. So I have to create separate recipes. And sometimes even for higher counts of linen, you have to do separate recipes for that. So there's a lot of testing that goes into just one color to try to get it consistent across the bases. Sometimes I can't.
You're chewing also, up a lot of linen just trying to get to something that you can sell.
Yeah, I mean, I can still sell it. You know, it just might be a solo because it's a little bit lighter than I want. Or, you know, there's I don't think I've ever dyed anything that I thought, oh, God, that's ugly. I've got to throw that away.
Okay.
You know, it's still sellable. It's just, it's not maybe going to be the final version of that color that I want. So I sell it as a solo. So test pieces go as solos, or if something doesn't turn out, you know, it isn't within the range. And that's also a really hard thing to decide sometimes. Like, a color will turn out a little bit lighter or a little bit darker than normal. And at what point is that not the same color?
Yeah.
That's a really hard call to make.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, I'm sure it's different for every dyer, but
right.
It's what I try to think of is, okay, so if a person bought, let's say, a color I have called Snow Day, and then they buy a solo, it has to look different enough that they're not disappointed that they got, like, you know, if it looks too close to the same color, they're going to be like, well, I just bought 2 pieces of the same color.
Yeah.
But so there's, you know, I try to think of it that way. Like, you know, does this look different enough that it's a different color and I should call it a solo, or is it still within range?
Mm-hmm.
But that's just, you know, that's just a judgment call.
Yeah. Huh. What is it like to source linen these days? Is it fairly easy to get blank or undyed linen?
Up to this point, yeah. I mean, I don't dye large enough quantities right now to order direct from Zweigart. I use Yarn Tree, and they always have what I need in stock. They're great.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the other thing. Sorry, I got to learn about linen here, so buckle up. Just buckle up. What is it that makes a good linen, and how do you know how it will take the dye? Is that experimental?
Yeah. Well, I decided I wanted to use Weygart linen because I already knew I liked it from having stitched on it.
Mm-hmm.
I like the feel of Weygart. The coverage when I'm stitching on it is good. So I already knew I liked that before I started dyeing fabric. So I just went with that.
Okay.
So to me, Weygart's good. I haven't tried a lot of other fabrics. You know, I've touched other kinds of fabrics and haven't necessarily enjoyed them. So I haven't stitched on them.
Mm-hmm.
So, most of my experience has been with Weygart, and, you don't know how it's going to take the dye. I mean, that's the testing process is, it's all like a big guessing game.
So that's the art. And that's the art of it then.
It's exactly. Like, if I want to dye something that's going to come out looking, I don't know, blue gray or brown gray or whatever, you know, first I'll just test the dyes that I have, and then I start mixing them together, and what it looks like when I, you know, make it into a liquid versus what it looks like when I combine it versus what it looks like when you stick it in the dye bath with, the fixative, and then you release the dye. I mean, it goes through so many color transformations that you can't guess for sure what you're, I mean, uh-huh. You're guessing obviously to begin with, but you just don't know what the final result is going to be until you've dried and pressed it. And like, for example, the fabric I was mentioning earlier, Snow Day, that's like a grayish blue color. And when I first test dyed that, I thought it was, I mean, it's supposed to be kind of a blue gray, but at one point it was purple in the dye bath. And I was like, oh God, but it came out beautiful in the end. But you know, I wouldn't have known that that was what was going to happen.
So it really is all the way through. You're just hoping it holds at the end then.
Yeah. And there's a lot of times where I think I'm getting a really nice deep color, and then it's out, you know, it turns out a lot softer. I mean, well, that's the true thing really about the whole process, is that you can get a pretty intense color to begin with, but by the time that you've fully processed the fabric, it's usually lighter than what you thought it was going to be. And obviously once you've dyed it once, you kind of know how it's going to work. But when you're testing, that's what I find to be true.
Now, is this all happening in the kitchen or?
Yep. Yep.
Really?
It happens in my kitchen. Yep. It makes eating, you know, I have to time my eating well. Because if my sink is full of fabric that's being dyed, or, you know, you got to keep your food away from it. So I have to be very careful, but yeah.
Okay. I didn't know in the basement, there's big, huge vats or just what you were doing, but
oh
right.
My gosh. If only I had a basement. I don't have a basement, but that would be awesome. Maybe someday I can have like a dye studio. That would be really great.
Yeah. Sounds like it's fun in a different way.
It is. And, you know, I really love developing new colors, and it's interesting to try to figure out, you know, how do I make this color work across different bases? Lugana usually dyes up lighter. Ada, the 18 count dyes up lighter usually than the 14 and the 16. So there's always like little challenges and, that keep it interesting for me.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of fun to develop a new color. Like, I get excited. Everybody else gets excited when I post it. It's pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's fun. And that color thing, you know, that was the one thing when I first saw your designs was, so often when I see people use really intense colors, they don't work for me. And that could just be me, but you tend to use pretty intense colors and make them come together. And is there an art background to you, or is that just the way you are?
It's not an art background, but I've done a lot of quilting. And so by doing a lot of quilting, I started to figure out my own color palette. And I would say that I agree with you that for me as well, sometimes like too many bright colors together are too strong for me. What I like is something that feels like bright and cheerful, but also calming in a way. And so I tend to use gray in my designs or in my color palettes to achieve that to some extent, to soften things.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of like to mix maybe some brighter colors with some softer colors to tone it down. So quilting was just kind of, I would say, where I developed and figured that out.
Mm-hmm.
And not just my own quilts, but I've also taught quilting classes and I worked at a quilt shop for a while. So sometimes I had to help people with pulling their own colors and they're not necessarily colors that I would work with, but trying to figure out like what's a harmonious palette, even if it's not my palette. So I just got a lot of practice, I think, thinking about what colors work together.
That old axiom of if you really want to learn something, try teaching it comes into play. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just like learning how to help people, I guess, find what they like too. You know, when I was working at the quilt shop, someone would come in and they wouldn't know what they wanted. And so the first thing is like, okay, well, let's find one fabric you like, and then we can try to pull from there. So, you know, that's kind of a really interesting and fun process, helping someone else figure out their color palette.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, so I just really, I really like color and I like thinking about color and I like noticing how other people use color.
Yeah.
And so I also like stitching other people's designs because they might use a color that I wouldn't have noticed or thought to start with, but then I'll be like, oh, I really like this color. And maybe I'll think about that, you know, in the future, like I would maybe consider it. Whereas maybe before I wouldn't even have noticed it.
Yeah. 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 That's interesting that you take that out of there. Cause I often wonder, and some designers never stitch anyone else's stuff and then others try to get to it, but never have time. But that becomes a learning tool for you then.
Yeah. I mean, well, one, it's relaxing because on my designs, I'm always making decisions when I'm stitching them. Like I'm still designing when I'm stitching. So there's a lot of thinking happening. So sometimes it's nice to stitch someone else's design just to check out a little bit and just have fun, not thinking, but yeah. I'm still thinking, you know, so I'm noticing like, okay, you know, these colors are interesting and maybe I wouldn't have necessarily like notice them, or it's interesting to see how this person outlines something, or you know, like how do you show depth in mm-hmm. a design, and mm-hmm. so like just kind of noticing what other people do, to me, yeah, it's a learning tool. And not that I necessarily want to do it exactly the same way, but it's just like, how does someone else, you know, like if you're going to learn how to paint, you want to look at how other people paint to think about that. And so if you want to design, thinking about how do other people approach this problem is I think useful.
Yeah. But see that, how do you keep that separation? How do you stay true to your own designs without being influenced by others, or is influence by others a good thing for your designs?
I'm not sure it's possible to not be influenced by others in a way, just because, you know, I mean, I've been stitching for a long time, so but I don't think my stuff looks like anyone else's stuff.
No.
So
no.
I don't know exactly that. I don't know how to answer that exactly because I'm not like consciously, it's not like I'm channeling someone and I'm like, stop, no, you know,
right.
I don't know exactly how you do that. I just, it's just that I notice, like, how does someone deal with depth or outlining or something? But then when I go in to do it myself, like, I'm still doing it my own way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm aware of what the options are of how other people do it, but I'm still drawing, like, my own version of a chickadee. Like, I'm not, like, looking at someone else's chickadee to draw it. You know,
right.
Usually when I want to draw an animal is I pull up pictures on photos. I pull up photos on Google and I just look at them and try to draw that.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's weird that I can't really answer your question.
Well, I don't think it's...
I don't know how you keep them separate.
I don't think it's weird at all, because the reason I have that question is I you know, when you hear musicians or songwriters interviewed, and the topic will come up from time to time of, am I staying true to my music Or at some point when I've become popular, am I writing songs that I know will sell?
Yeah.
And then that, you know, that conflict comes into the picture where who am I? And am I, mm-hmm. and you'll hear artists, musicians who say, well, this album, I got back to my roots because mm-hmm. I had been over here and I really just felt out of place. And, you know, I got to believe consciously or not that that happens with needlework designers too, where, you know, well, this will sell because I did another one like this that will sell. But then your other side of your mind is saying, well, yeah, but over here is where I really want to be.
Right. I've actually been having this conversation a lot lately, just kind of post-market thinking about that. And, you know, how do you keep that separate of what do you think people want versus, you know, what do you want to do? And are those opposing things or not? Because you don't want to lose yourself.
Right.
Trying to do whatever you think other people are looking for. You know, what I like is to get suggestions of things like a topic. And then if I feel like exploring it, you know, I will, but in my own way. I think maybe this kind of is related to your question a little bit, which is that like when I'm designing, the way that I know a design is good or is ready is that I'm excited to stitch it. Mm. And maybe that doesn't actually answer your question, but to me, it's somehow related, like that it's gone through a process of starting with like nothing and it's gotten to some other point and it doesn't look like anything else other than me, I guess, at that point. I mean, not that it ever really looked like someone else, but it's a really good question. I don't know.
Well, it's just a curiosity point for me, because, you know, those interviews, but then as a magazine editor, and I've told this story before, I will leaf through competitive magazines, mm-hmm. but I have never in 40 years religiously read competitive magazines because I don't want that influence in my head.
Right.
You know, I want to stick to what I know is what I think is a good magazine and what I think will help my readers do their mm-hmm. jobs better because they're trade magazines. And so I don't want that influence in my head. So I consciously avoid it. And mm-hmm. it to me that relates, it's the same kind of thing with an art like you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know. It's just an interesting psychological exchange to me that goes on, and it's hard, especially in the art world. I'm sure it's very hard, but certainly you can't go through days without seeing other people's work, especially in needlework.
Right.
But you know, you still have to keep your focus on, you know, I hate this phrase, but I'm going to use it, on your North Star, where you're trying to get to, and not be pulled off of that.
Well, I think one thing that helps me is that, even though I might stitch someone else's design, I'm not really remembering it when I'm designing. Like I might remember that someone designed a tree, mm-hmm. but I'm not going to like look at their tree while I'm designing my tree. I'll look at a real tree and think, okay, well, what does the Misty tree look like? You know, what is the Misty version of this? And so that's my way of, being able to interact with other designs, but not be in, you know, not be using them in my designs.
Yeah. 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 It's just
that's a great question.
Interesting aspect.
Are you asking everyone this question? You should ask more designers that question.
Oh, I think I do every now and then, but not always. Yeah. Not always. It depends. It just depends.
Yeah. Cause that's I would love to pick more designers' brains just about their process. You know, what is someone's ritual for creativity? And, you know, do they always like, you know, does someone have to design in the same place or at the same time, or how do they get ideas? I think that kind of stuff's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, and see, those kinds of things is where I would like to get half dozen or eight designers in a room with an afternoon.
Mm-hmm. And yeah,
just,
that would be cool.
Yeah, just see what comes out of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you'd have to get over that initial hump of, uncomfortable. Can I share, you know, and then get people to relax and just talk about, cause yeah, there's all of that. You know, do your designs come from you in the middle of the night? Do they come from you when you're out walking the dog? What is it that makes it happen for you? And are you carting around a sketchbook all the time? You know, just what is mm-hmm. it? And everybody has a different way.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that stuff's so interesting. I just like hearing about people's process.
Right. Oh, I do too. Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes they'll even think about their process and you can see little lights going on. Like, oh, wait a minute. What if I did this? And yeah, the whole art thing, the whole art process. Yes. It's just hearing you talk about even dyeing linen. I can hear that in there too. That art process is in there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know. It's fun to learn about that. And when you design, is it the color first? Is it the subject matter? Where does that start for you?
It pretty much always starts with a subject.
Okay.
And I've experimented with designing just in like one or two colors and adding the color later to see what happens. And I've experimented with just, you know, designing and starting with whatever colors to begin with. And I don't find that one way is really better than the other, but I guess I find that I prefer to work with the colors I think I might use later on. So I've switched to pretty much just doing that. But sometimes I have an idea of like some words that I want to work with, you know, like coffee first. The words were the start of that design. And mm-hmm. then finally the chickadee on the teacup came to me, and then the rest of it developed over time. Sometimes it's an image and I just have part of the image, and then I kind of have to find my way to the rest of the design. That happens a lot. And that's kind of been I think that's just my creative process in writing. It's been the same way that, you know, if I write a story or I write even like a research paper, whatever writing I'm trying to do, I don't usually know where it's going. I start with an idea and I have to write my way through it. And it's the same thing with my designs. Like I have some general kernel to start with, and then I just have to keep kind of sitting down at the computer and saying, okay, what if I do this? And what if I do that? And eventually it comes together somehow.
That's interesting to hear that, because one of the jobs, and I hate it, is every issue I have to write an editorial, and I hate it. I just hate it. But you know, it's got to be done. And then you look at newspaper people who have to write a column every day, and oh man, I so admire those people who can do that and do it well, because that is skill beyond skill. And people will say, well, yeah, but they can choose any topic. It doesn't matter. You still got to deliver. And
yeah.
But I do that process when I have to write an editorial. If I don't have a subject that I want to write, is I'll just start throwing down words, just thoughts. Yeah. And sit at the machine and just throw them down. And pretty soon one sentence becomes two, and then it'll start to build, and then off I go.
Yeah.
And then I have something, I write it, and I'm done, and that's, you know, off my back till the next thing, next month. But it sounds like you have that happening in your designs where.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never know. Well, I rarely know in advance, like what the setting is or what the story is behind the design. And so I have to kind of find my way to that. And it's kind of, for me, maybe because I'm a newer designer, it's an uncomfortable process, because you think to yourself, like, well, I have this really good idea, but is it ever going to go anywhere? And, you know, sometimes it's a long period of not being quite sure if the design's going to make it or not. And eventually, you know, I may lose interest and then it doesn't make it. And that happens sometimes. Or like I get over that hump far enough where I'm like, okay, this is going to make it. And I just have to keep, you know, following this path and trying different things. And I really like to just mess around and like, what if I tweak this one thing? Or what if I move this here? What if I change this color a little bit? And there's all kinds of happy accidents that happen while I'm designing, especially on the computer, because you're, you know, moving things around. You move a motif over here and maybe you see something you didn't see before because the computer, whatever happened, and it got stuck somewhere, you know, before, like you were trying to move it somewhere else and it got stuck on the way. And you're like, oh, like that happened with, a Cardinal's Carol, which is a design I released at Christmas. So I had bells on the design, and then I was trying to put a snowflake in, and I went to move the snowflake, and I don't know if it got stuck on the bell or if I just moved it over the bell to another part of the design. I'm like, oh, I could just put that on the bell as like a motif, you know? So like serendipity happens all the time while I'm messing around on the computer. So I really like designing on the computer actually for that reason. I start with a, usually I start with a sketch, but moving it to the computer for me works really well after that.
Yeah. Well, that was the other thing, because you describe your work as what, cute and whimsical. And and the first time I read that, I thought, well, that's pretty bold, because usually for cute and whimsical, to me, that means silly. Like, I got no interest whatsoever. And but then you, to me, it's, you deliver a different definition of that combination of words. And the one that sticks out for me is the one with the rabbit. The rabbit and the bird. I forget what you, what that one's called. But the rabbit has an expression to it, the way you designed the body, that, that immediately elicits a story.
Yeah.
Whatever story anybody, any viewer might put to it. But there's something you do there that, for me, the cute and whimsical comes out in a positive way. I'm not describing this right, but from my mind, a positive way, in that, yeah, there's a cuteness and there's a something going on there that, that elicits an interaction with the bird. And, that, you know, that works so well there.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I think for me, whimsical, what I'm trying to say by whimsical is, playful, maybe a little bit clever, sometimes maybe a little something unexpected. Yeah, playful, I would say, more than not really silly in what I'm thinking of whimsical for the, what I'm thinking about my own designs anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that, that it's a different, not really definition, but just a different view of whimsical that you deliver than I would normally see. And, you know, and I mean, because a lot of that stuff, I mean, for some people, that's what they enjoy. And I, you know, I'm not faulting anyone for that. But I, for me, it's like, ah, no, thanks, pass. And of course, I've got that male problem too, where a lot of this stuff just doesn't appeal to me just because. But
yeah, well, that's okay.
Yeah, it's the way it is. But yeah, no, you pull it off. And that was what caught my eye the first time I saw your work, was there was this extra little dimension to it that, for the style of things you do, that I don't normally see. And so that was, it was exciting to me anyway.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I'm trying to do cute, but like, and like kind of like a sophisticated cute, if that's a thing. I don't know. I'm trying to make it a thing. If it's not a thing, I'm trying
well,
to
I
make
think
it
is.
Thing, I guess.
No, I think it is. I think that, that it is a thing. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think there is a sophistication to that, and that's what makes it work. And then the way you bring in the colors, just adds to it. And I think definitely. Yeah. No, there's just something there that, that is not, common. So, you know, bravo for that.
Thank you. Yeah. I feel like I'm coming into my voice more the past several months, which has been pretty cool. Like, I feel like my designs are looking pretty coherent. And I feel like they look like me. And I feel like I'm getting better at designing because, or the way that I, that suggests to me that I'm getting better is that, I'm always excited to stitch my own stuff, but I'm moving towards wanting to stitch my own stuff more, like where I'm not, and this is not any diss to any designer at all, but I'm just feeling like, oh, I really want to stitch my own thing more than I want to stitch someone else's design.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's a good sign that I'm moving in the right direction with my work.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, it would be interesting to come back to you, and maybe we just will in a couple of years, and just see how that mental process has worked through. Because I'm sure for every designer, there is some kind of a road and stair step up, you know, up to different levels as you get more experience at it and you start to see things more. And that's interesting. Yeah, I'm getting to the point where I'd rather stitch my own stuff than someone else's. So, you know, that's got to be a step in there somewhere. Yes. Do you design on the fly? Well, I guess you said you normally start with a sketch. Do you chart it out and then stitch it, or do you stitch it and then chart it?
I very rarely just sit down at the computer with no idea. Mm-hmm. But I have on occasion done that. Usually I just do like a loose sketch in a sketchbook to give myself a sense for size, scale, spatially, how things might be related to each other. Sometimes it's a decent artistic sketch and sometimes it's not much better than stick figures, but I'm just trying to, you know, I'm just trying to get something really basic down, and then I can go into the computer, and then I do all my design work really in the computer. And I'm not importing the image from the sketchbook. I'm just looking at what I drew and then redrawing it.
Okay.
In the computer. So I guess in one way, I'm just trying to notice, like, what are the lines? Like, if I'm drawing a rabbit, you know, what's its face shape like? And what's its body shape like? So I'm doing that first on the sketchbook and then kind of doing it again in the computer. And then once I've got the whole thing designed, then I start stitching it, and I may tweak things. You know, usually it's just colors I'm tweaking, but once in a while I'll notice something as I'm stitching where I'm like, well, this would be a little better if I did it this way. Or sometimes what'll happen is I'll be stitching like the border and I'll have part of it stitched and I'll be like, wow, this really looks good just like this. Maybe I won't add in this other color I was going to use. So designing for me happens even throughout the stitching, which is part of why I haven't felt comfortable asking for model stitchers, because I still make a lot of changes, not like major changes to the design, but, you know, sometimes the color, you know, it's really interesting pulling colors for a design, because what they look like on the skein or how they look together, you know, all on skeins, is not necessarily how they look once you're actually stitching them on your fabric. And once they're interacting with your fabric in a smaller way, you know, where there's just two strands or one strand, sometimes something's too bright or it's not quite the right shade. And even though I have, you know, developed a color sense, it still doesn't mean that I don't have to change things.
Right.
And so when I was stitching farm fresh eggs, I got stuck for a while on that because it seemed like the color was off and I was like, did I pick the wrong fabric? And I finally realized it was just the shade of red was a little bit too bright and I had to go like a shade lighter, and then it was fine.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of thing happens frequently enough.
Yeah, I first got exposed to that little dynamic talking with Gayanne Rogers, who is an absolute master. But she talked at some length in a show about that very thing, that it's the color, but it's not really the color. It's what's next to it and how the light mm-hmm. bounces off of it, and all that comes into play. And so the color you think it is probably not it. It's something else, yeah.
That's very true about two colors being next to each other. Yes. Yeah. I find that too.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll never be a designer, but I just find the process and those little dynamics just fascinating, because done right, they make it work, and done not right, it, you know, a good design could just be blah. And yeah.
Yeah, I agree. It's a really fascinating process, and it's one that it's difficult to explain in a way. Like, why do I choose this particular shade of yellow versus that one? You know, sometimes, or why do I decide something should be yellow or blue? You know, sometimes it's not easy to say why, but, you know, I think you could show someone how two colors look when they're next to each other and you can explain that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's like a certain aspect of color that I think is teachable or easy to explain, but I think the sometimes like why you choose a certain color is harder, like in a design. Sometimes I guess it's just based on what are you trying to make stand out in the design and what do you want to recede?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At some point, it's just art, too. You know, it really is just art.
And, yeah, that's true.
I think at some point it just simply can't be explained. It's in your head. It's what works, what looks right and what works, and it's art, and you just make it happen. Yeah. Yeah. We have a studio. Yeah, do you have a studio at the house there?
I just have like an extra bedroom, and that's, you know, where I do a lot of my work. I have a master bedroom and I have a smaller bedroom, and I like to joke that, you know, I have priorities. So the larger bedroom is where all the crafting happens and the smaller bedroom is where the sleep happens because I don't need a lot of room to sleep, but I need a lot of room to make things. So, so I have my priorities.
Oh, it's going to make it hard to show the house when you, get ready to sell it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm renting, so.
Oh, okay.
But yes, it will be complicated. I'll have to clean up and tidy up.
Dying in the kitchen and stitching in the master bedroom. All right. Yeah. That works. Yep.
I have to find someone who crafts who would want to move in here.
Right. Can understand. Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So what's next on the design front? We got something coming out here in the summer, or what are your plans?
Yeah.
That you're willing to share, of course.
Yeah, I'm working on a patriotic piece for the summer, and what I'm trying to figure out right now is how many things I want to release this summer. My schedule's a little, it's not too bad, but I got a little off trying to get ready for market, and I'm trying to get myself a little bit farther ahead again.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just trying to figure out, like, how many designs do I want to release this summer versus maybe hold back a little bit to try and get some things farther in advance ready. And mm-hmm. I'm trying to also think about maybe every time I release designs, holding one back for market next year. So I can be more ready than I was this year in terms of like more time.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's going to work, but that's what I'm rethinking my process a little bit. But so I have a patriotic piece and it's going to be a Quaker. I've been wanting to do a Quaker design for a while. And one of my design goals is to do a Halloween Quaker because I love Halloween. I'm not quite to a Halloween Quaker yet, but I'm doing something on a small scale that's a Quaker. So that'll be coming out this summer. And I have a larger design that I'm working on that I don't know if it's gonna make it or not. So that one's up in the air. So it's close to maybe working, but I just can't quite figure it out. I just don't know if it's going to make it. And I've tried like positioning it a bunch of different ways and I just don't know yet. So that one's an unknown.
So you have multiples going all the time then?
Yeah, I've already got designs planned for the fall that are pretty well designed, and I've got something for Christmas. I've got maybe a new series coming that it wasn't supposed to be a series, but now that I'm messing around with it, it's looking like it could be a series. So mm-hmm. I'm experimenting with that. I'm thinking about a Christmas design that could be a series for next year, and that's kind of partially designed. So lots of things are in progress right
yes.
now. The patriotic piece, I'm almost ready to start stitching that one. I've been pulling colors and dyeing fabric for it. So.
And do you do that? The dyeing is, that must be a benefit for you. You can say, all right, I've got this design and I need a cloth to go with it. So I'm going to go make a color.
It's a pro and a con. If I can get the color quickly, it's like, you know, yay, I've got this. It's tricky. Like, you know, when I'm going to release a new color, there's a lot of testing that goes into it. So it's really easier on me if I don't suddenly create a new color for a new design, but sometimes that's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
But it's nice that, you know, I have all these recipes, and if I need a piece of fabric, I can go make it in my kitchen.
Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, it's very convenient. And it's just, you know, it's a little tricky then if I don't have anything that's quite right. Like, okay, am I going to try to come up with something right now, or am I going to use someone else's fabric? Or like, you know, in the case of preparing for market, there was just no way I could get all those designs done and dye all that fabric for my own shop. So yeah. It was great to be able to use some Picture This Plus fabric too in some of my designs. Mm-hmm. That was really helpful. So, but it's great being able to, I mean, there's still work involved. There's a reason that hand-dyed fabric is never available. It's because it's quite time consuming to make it happen. There's a lot of steps to it, but, it's really nice that I have that option. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Misty, thank you so much. This has been fun.
Thank you, Gary. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. I learn things. It's the best. All right. Well, thanks for doing this, and we'll look forward to your designs here coming up. Thanks to Fire Poppies for sponsoring, and to everyone for listening.
Thank you.